The Story of Victor Jacob Hochhalter, an autobiography of how he survived the Russian Gulag. Originally written in German in his own hand, typed and translated by his daughter Molly Michael Nee Amelie. Narrated by his great grandson, Brian Rayner. I was born June 1st, 1909, and named Victor Jacob Hochhalter. My great-grandfather Hochhalter came from Baden-Baden to Russia. Grandfather Engel came from Prussia. Both parents, Jacob and Dorothea, were born in Russia, in the town of Novodzing, in the district of Cherson. Father had six natural siblings, three sisters and three brothers, and one adopted sister, all of which came to know well. Mother also had six siblings, four sisters and two brothers. I only knew two sisters and one brother. When my parents married, they received 12 desjatin land. One desjatin is a little more than 1 hectare. After selling and reselling their land, both parents and grandparents Hochhalter moved to another district where they purchased more land. I was told that I was born in Papasnaja and lived there a very short time. With the eruption of war and the revolution, the birth certificate was destroyed and a new one was issued in Nudenzing. Now on with the story as I remember it. We lived in a small settlement with 4 estates. Uncle Philip Hochhalter, who had 100 desjatin land, Uncle Robert Kramer, father's eldest sister and family, who had 80 desjatin land, my parents with 65 desjatin, and Uncle Henry Mickelson, father's younger sister and family, with 55 desjatin. I remember well living in the barn until the house was built, even though I was not old enough to walk. I may have been 1 or 1.5 years old. My brother as a baby and my 2 sisters are also fond memories. There was a 3rd sister who died as an infant. The war erupted in 1914, and I was 5 years old. My father, his 3 brothers, and 2 brothers-in-law were all drafted. Grandfather was the only man who remained to run the farms. There were my 2 cousins, Robert and David Kammerer, who were 12 and 14 years old. The rest of the children were much younger. We had 4 horses, 2 cows, pigs, sheep, fowl, and some agricultural machinery. The other 3 estates were approximately the same in proportion to size. Each estate had 1 or 2 prisoners of war, and a few hired hands to help, but the responsibility of the running of all 4 was on my grandfather's shoulders. The biggest problem was that all business had to be conducted in a Ukrainian village. Grandfather and 1 aunt spoke Russian. The others could not speak or understand the language. Although father and his brothers were in the Red Army, they spoke the language, and they were now considered the enemy. Father did not serve in the front lines. He was delegated to retrieve broken weapons and return them after they were repaired. Now and again, he would work in the repair shop, but seldom. Most of his time was spent traveling. This presented the opportunity to come home every so often, and thus he could check on things. He and my mother corresponded constantly, and so he could make a few decisions concerning the farm, but not enough. Mother had to make many decisions on her own. When father came home again, we only had 2 horses, 2 cows, very few pigs, and much less of everything. Some of the land had also been leased. In October 1917, the Civil War began. The Reds came with their demands. Then the White Army came with their demands, not to mention the various bands such as the Makhno, Maryushka, Selini, and so forth. So the estates began to shrink. the demands of the Reds worsened, and they began to murder and rob. In 1918, the Germans marched into the Ukraine near our village. The headquarters were in the neighboring village. Horses were stolen on one estate, and an elderly man was arrested for the theft. He had been a shepherd for my father at one time, and father knew him well. Father was convinced that the man was innocent, and he went to speak to the commandant on the man's behalf. The man was released. The villagers were angry, since one of their men was arrested for the crime and tortured shamefully. Father knew nothing about this. However, when the Germans lost power, and the Reds came into power again, they arrested my father and tortured him in the same way. They tied him to the back of the horse-drawn wagon and dragged him through the streets, whipping him with a horsewhip as they went. Then they added much more cruel and shameful torture after that. The Germans came back into power, but father did not seek revenge. However, when the Reds advanced again, he became nervous, since the three of his brothers served in the White Army. He loaded all of their belongings onto a wagon in the night and drove to the train station. His brother was a station master, and so with his help, everything was loaded onto a freight car. We climbed on top and rode into the unknown. Father said we would go as far as the train would take us. It turned out to be not far at all, 100 kilometers from home to Slojansk, into a town called Dans Klobekin. We spent 3 nights in an inn, and father found a place to call home the next day. A new life began for our family. Father already spoke Russian, and as all children, the four of us did not take long to learn the language. Mother never did master it. The battle continued back and forth, but it soon became obvious that the Reds would win in the end. The whole industrial system was demolished through the Civil War. The Reds were not overly concerned, nor able to do much towards the rebuilding of the system. Trade and supply came to a standstill. The only thing now functioning was the black market, and it blossomed. Not everyone can live in this system. The railroad, which is still Russia's main means of transportation, was at a standstill for weeks at a time as the bandits, both red and white, took over. The Tsar's money was rendered worthless immediately after the revolt. For a short time, Kerensky's money was used. He was the head of the... He was the head of the Povestsoryushche government. Then came the Soviets' money. In Petrograd, now Leningrad, and Moscow, the Soviets, with Lenin as their head, grasped the power and held on. But throughout the country, the fighting continued, with large or small bands. Often, brother fought against brother and father against sons. In time, Lenin and the far left managed to bring peace, peace being the end of open battles. However, the Battle of the Classes... However, the Battle of the Classes had just begun. Back to my family. During these hard years, father busied himself with business transactions. Sometimes driving from village to village, trading food for clothing and other needed items. He was not always fortunate enough to arrive home with all the food. Once, for example, a whole wagon load of flour, 10 sacks, was stolen from him. But the need was so great, he had to keep trying again and again, and he did manage to bring us through the difficult years when so many starved to death. My sister had private tutoring, and I went to a private German school. Then we both went on to high school. But after my first year in high school, all private schools were closed, and government schools were opened. In my third year, they were no longer free, and father could not afford to send all four of us, so he thought it would be easier for a man to do manual labor than a woman, and he asked my brother and myself to drop out of school and find a job. We were not disappointed, first of all. Even though studies came easy for me, I did not like school. Secondly, there were very few boys my age in school, since times had been so hard when we started school, there had been very few families who could send their children. Later, they had been closed. For a short time, we owned a bakery. My parents baked the bread, and I took it to market. I was young, but strong and big for my age. Later, I helped father with his deliveries. In 1923, I was 14 years old, and things became a little more stable, at least in our region. New money was issued and held its worth. In Hasaroka, a small rail stop, stood a big mill. Two brothers, Jacob and Peter Simons, had been managers. However, it stood closed now. It belonged to the government. They formed an advisory committee. Members of the committee worked in the mill, and there was only one non-member allowed to work there. He was the mechanic. My father was the machinist and stocker for the steam engine. We, mother and children, stayed in Slojanks until spring. Father found an apartment for us, and we went to join him. We had to share our home with another family. We each had two rooms, a pantry, and a large and small hallway, a kitchen and basement. We also had a small shelter for the cattle and poultry. Our co-tenants were Jacob and Catherine Weeb and their children. Uncle Weeb, as we called him, worked in the oil mill. We all got along very well. Even to this day, Tanta Weeb and I correspond regularly. My eldest sister died when we were living in this home. After 1 year, we were able to move to another home with a private entrance, but our friendship with the Weeb family remained strong. As long as I can remember, I have been fascinated with the working of machines. I can remember the horse-drawn threshing machine. I can remember the horse-drawn threshing machine. The horse pulled a mechanism which created a wave. This turned a wheel and a belt and started the thresh. The horse pulled a mechanism which created a wave. This turned a wheel and a belt and started the threshing. This was fascinating and thrilling to me. Later came the steam combustion engine. This was an even greater adventure. For me, it was magic. When Father worked the day shift in Hasaroka, my greatest pleasure was to spend the day with him. Now and again I was allowed to oil the machines, put a few shovels of coal into the fire, start or stop the water pump, etc. Soon I was able and allowed to do this on my own, plus bag the bran and sew the bags. Thus I earned a little money. In 1924, a permanent machinist was needed. I was only 15 years old, and legally not old enough to take the job, and I was not a member of the co-op. But somehow, they added a year to my birth date, and I was hired. At first, my father came and checked my work frequently, but he soon realized how much I enjoyed the job, and therefore did it very well. He relaxed, and the others seemed satisfied with my work. In November 1925, my uncle, my father's brother, and my cousin, David Karamer, started a new co-op. Father decided to join them, and soon I followed. Now I was already 16, and I could join legally. We rented a mill from the government in Bolgeska Kirastopoka. It had two rolling stones, two millstones, and a small oil mill with a press. Our power plant was a gas-driven auto-Dietz motor. This was also operated by the co-op members, except for the head mechanic. Julius Simons, the son of one of the co-op members in Hrvatska, was our director. He also worked his shift at the mill. I became his assistant for a few months, and then I was on my own. For a whole year, I worked 12 hours a shift, and I always had to work the night shift. Simons was the director, and he also had epilepsy, and we did not want him working nights. In the fall and winter, the mill was so busy, we were open day and night. We would close Sunday morning and reopen Sunday evening. I had one day a week off. We lived in a commune setting, with 12 of us sharing accommodations. Uncle August was the only one who had his family with him. In spite of our hard work and long hours, the business did not do well, and we earned very little. Our flour was not as good as some of the neighboring mills. We purchased silk, very expensive sieves, and the flour improved a little. However, there was now too much bran left over. We had to give our clients the same weight in the flour as the wheat they had brought in, and we received a percentage of the flour for us. The power plant broke down often and was stopped for hours, sometimes even days at a time, so we lost a lot of customers. Simon's health began to fail. It may have been due to the problems at the mill, or this may have just made it worse. He left, and several left with him. In the meantime, the mill in Hosroka. In the meantime, the mill in Hosroka closed down. My father came to Christopaka. My father came to Christopoka and brought several men with money with him. Father was elected director, since he had many connections. He found a good mechanic, Supon, J.J. Much he and I would meet again in Siberia. He was very familiar with our motors and machines. Then Father found a good miller by the name of Lensko, P.A. I had been there the longest and knew the job well, but did not know how to fasten the rolls, how many threads per inch, the types of sieves needed, and how many cubes per inch or what frame to use. It was summertime, work was slow, so we closed the mill and did a complete renovation. Lensko came and showed me how to do all the things I could not understand. The motors were thoroughly cleaned and were ready for fall. Lensko came back. Lensko came back, checked everything, clarified a few things, and work began. We had good flour, very little bran, an even lower percentage than was allowed. The word soon got around the village, and we were in business again. Now we were back, 7 days a week, Sunday evening to Sunday morning, and even at that, our clients had to wait 2 weeks for their turn. Before long, we had to hire more workers and had 3 8-hour shifts. We earned $75 per month. According to law, we were not allowed to earn more. We devised ways to extend our pay. Clothing was issued by the business, along with 200 pounds of flour, 220 pounds of oil, oil cakes for heating, and food for cattle. But even without the extras, 75 rubles would have been a very good salary in Russia at that time. The average income was much lower, and unemployment was very high. With two of us working at the mill and the family all together again, things seemed very good. In 1 year, we had saved enough to buy a house. Now the question arose, where to buy? My mother and sister were born again and baptized. Father came from a Baptist home. I cannot take it upon myself to judge him and say that he was or was not born again, but he was not baptized. He did attend church whenever possible. Father loved music, and he loved to sing. Whenever the whole family was at home, we would sing from the Russian hymnal. I'm very proud to say he was a very honest and just man who worked hard for his family. He put himself into life-threatening situations to provide food and clothing for us. Many people around us were starving in those days. In Postajanka, a small village about 4 kilometers from our village of Christopoka, there was a small Baptist church which we attended on Sundays. Now, Engels, my mother's brother and family, and Leschinks, mother, sister, and family, moved to our village. Both uncles worked in the mill. Uncle Leschinsky had 4 sons, Arthur, Otto, Victor, and Fred. Victor died as a young boy. Arthur and Otto were killed during the Second World War, along with many others, and Fred is living in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As I mentioned earlier, the Baptist church was small, and most of the members were elderly and illiterate. Things were a little better in the cities. From 1925 to 1929, a young couple, probably not from the village, as they were both well-educated, served as the pastor. He was a cobbler by profession, which was also, or mostly, a front, as he did not make many shoes. The shoes he did make were very good quality. He was a cobbler by profession, which was also, or mostly, a front, as he did not make many shoes. The shoes he did make were very good quality. They rented a small home, which served as a home, business, and sanctuary on Sunday. They visited many homes and explained the Word of God. As I look back now, I believe they must have been sent by a mission board. Until 1938, religion was more or less free. Churches and cities were open for worship. However, in the village, the Russian Orthodox, or Rite Faith, as I like to call themselves, tried very hard to suppress or do away with all other faiths. So as our little church grew, pressure was applied, and since the chairman of the town council was also chairman of the church council, in those days, it was still allowed to work in a government position and believe in God. It did not take long to send our pastor away, and worship services were silenced. I must mention one more thing here. In those days, if a girl or a woman bore a child out of wedlock, the father, or a man or a boy, if over 16 years, had to marry the mother, or 25% of his wages were deducted from his wages monthly and given to the mother. This seems only right if the man accused is the father. However, too often this was not the case, and money was withdrawn from his wages, and he had to bear the shame for something he did not do. All that was necessary to prove him guilty was for the mother to go before a judge, swear that he was the father, and one witness to say they had seen them together. Of course, it was just coincidence that all the accused men happened to be the ones earning the most money. This was of great concern to my parents, as I was 19 years of age, my sister 26, and my brother 16. As mentioned earlier, my father and I earned a good wage and had enough money to buy a house. Pavlograd, a small town of 30 to 35,000, was 35 kilometers from work, and a small German Mennonite village called Herzenberg, Alexanderoka in Russian, was 20 kilometers away. Father decided to go to Herzenberg and see what he could find. He found a house which he thought was suitable, and he and mother went back to buy it from Mr. Newman, who had two houses on one courtyard. The Newman house was built in the style of most Mennonite houses in Russia. There was the big room, the corner room, the small room, the summer room, etc. The barn and stables were attached to the house with a double door and hallway into the stable and a large double gate. Our house was more like the city houses. We had three large rooms, a big kitchen, a pantry, a basement, and a large hallway. We had a very strong ceiling, and all the grain was stored. We had a very strong ceiling, as all the grain was stored in the attic. Outdoors, we had some fruit trees and 1/2 hectare land for a vegetable garden. We added a shed. We purchased a cow and a horse, which we kept in the neighbor's stable. She was an elderly lady named Sarah Fiesman. Our house was built of burned brick with a sheet metal roof. In the spring of 1928, we moved in. That is, my mother, sister, and brother moved in. Father and I remained in Christopoka. We rented a room, stayed there during the week, and went home on weekends. Now, we lived among German-speaking people. But my brother and I understood very little German, and our speech was even worse. My sister spoke German fluently. She did very well with the Low German, which most of the Mennonites spoke. They understood and spoke both, but their main language was Low German. It seems to me that women do better in the language department than men, since my daughter also has a much better command of the German language than do her two brothers. Back to my story. We, my brother and I, joined the youth group. We spoke Russian, and they answered in German, or sometimes in Low German. The Wilms family were some of the few who spoke Russian. They lived on the opposite end of the village from our house. Our first Saturday in the village, they came and introduced themselves and invited us to come to the youth group. Abraham was my age, born in 1909. John and Henry were older. They had a sister, Lena, who was 2 or 3 years my junior, and was one of the first to befriend my sister. I began to notice that she was at the house every Saturday when I came home from the weekends. We would talk for a while, and then I would walk her home. Since she spoke Russian better than the other girls, and was not exactly bad-looking, and since she did not ignore me, we usually met on Sunday also. Thus the time passed quickly. About 6 months later, maybe a year later, I learned that Lena had dated another young man before we came to Herzenberg, Cornelius Reimer. He had gone to Chortiz, where he was studying to be a teacher, and he had met someone else, whom he later married. But I noticed that Lena was still in love with him and hoped to get him back. I asked her to marry me. The answer, not yet, Let's just be friends for now. I told her I did want to remain friends also, but things would change between us, and they did. I told her I wanted to remain friends, but things would change between us, and they did. She was no longer at the house when I arrived at home for weekends, and we no longer met on Sundays. But when we met at the youth group, we were cordial to each other and did remain very good friends. In the meantime, my German had improved considerably. When one is young and willing, almost nothing is impossible, and love even makes it easy. In the center of the village lived a large family, Jacob and Helen Epp, and their 9 children, Elizabeth, Mary, Abraham, Frank, Lena, Katerina, Olga, Peter, and Greta. Tina was a beautiful, sensible girl, but she looked so young. She was young, only 15 years old. I had my eye on her for a while. Then I noticed that she seemed to be watching me, too. Since Epps had such a large family and lived in the center of the village, most of the meetings were held at their home. But sometimes we met at the home of the Wilms or at Tia Cribb's, since they also had large families. One evening, when we met at one of these homes, I asked Tina's permission to escort her home. She said she would not mind. Much later, after we were married, she told me how thrilled she had been that I'd asked her. This was the beginning for us. As mentioned earlier, I worked in Christopoka at the mill and only came home on weekends, so we did not see each other often. But in spite of this, or maybe because of it, we became closer and closer. Now I must divert from this story a little and talk about the conditions in the country at the time. From 1925 to 1929 must have been the best years of the Soviet regime. Stalin came to power and was determined to fulfill his plan. In the cities, all businesses were given to the government. At first, only the large ones, and many owners of small businesses thought it only right. But before long, everything belonged to the government. Of course, the government did not just walk in and take over. The taxes just rose and rose until no one was able to pay. And then the government just took over. Some owners understood the situation sooner than others, and they simply left. But others did not get the message fast enough and were imprisoned or sent to Siberian labor camps. In the villages, the collective farms were to be built, and according to communist theory, this was to be completely voluntary, because surely the farmers would recognize how much easier and more profitable it would be than their small farms. The farmers, however, did not want to give their farms, no matter how small they were. So the pressure started. For example, 25,000 communist workers were sent to the village. Also, the activities were those who own no property, and the explanation began. The large estate owners, as the large businesses, were simply smothered with taxes. Then they also had to deliver grain, cattle, and other foodstuffs whenever they had them on their farm or not. I remember Mr. Jansen, at one time the wealthiest man in our town. They came and took most of his land in 1939 to 1930. But he did. I remember Mr. Jansen, at one time the wealthiest man in our town. They came and took most of his land in 1939. But he still did quite well. And then they taxed him, and he paid. They taxed him again, and he paid, and again, till finally he had nothing left. Then they drove him and his family. I remember Mr. Jansen, at one time the wealthiest man in our town. They came and took most of his land in 1939, but he still did quite well. Then they taxed him, and he paid. They taxed him again, and he paid, and again, till finally he had nothing left. And then they drove him and his family from their property with nothing but the clothes on their backs. And he was one of the fortunate ones. Most of them were driven to Siberia. This happened to my father-in-law, but more about that later. These wealthy farmers were not being called Kulikin, or Fist, which was to say, they were the rich taking away from the poor. Or they were only concerned about themselves, and so the government was helping the poor by distributing the wealth. This served two purposes. They got the property they wanted, and the fear made the others weaker. No one was immune to be calling Kulikin, and it soon became standard practice. When no other crime would fit, this one fit nicely. The average farmer, as well as the poor, were drafted into the kolkhoz. They were all called to a village council meeting, where the kolkhoz was explained. The farmers all voted against it. Then the farmers were called individually, and the program was explained more clearly, namely, brainwashing. The explanation included a revolver being pounded on the desk for emphasis, beatings, slamming the door, or fingers, and the educational methods. They were also kept for days without sleep. The guards or officers would change shifts and kept the farmers up until they were willing to sign their farms over to the kolkhoz. When the majority had been persuaded, another general meeting was called, and it was not voluntary. The majority voted for the kolkhoz. In Russia, nothing is done without a vote, and the majority always wins. When the majority is wrong, they are re-educated, and another vote is taken. There were still a few who voted against the kolkhoz. These were given the worst land, as far from a village as possible. If they went quietly, worked their farms, they were called an enemy of the people, and were not allowed to sell anything at the co-op. There were no other stores to buy or sell anything. They were not allowed to vote, associate with anything, anyone who is a member of the kolkhoz, or the others were also ostracized. Then, in the end, everything was taken away from them anyway, and they were driven like cattle to the train station, loaded on cattle cars, and taken to Siberia, Ural, and other uninhabited places. This happened in the middle of winter. They were immediately put to work felling trees. Late at night, they were allowed to work at building some kind of shelter for themselves and their families. They received very little and very bad food. In a short time, most of them found their home under the birch, as the Russian expression goes, and most of them were children. But some of them did survive even this, and we would meet them later, when we were sent to Siberia. They were free again, and the greatest miracle was they were once again well-to-do, at least by Russian standards in those days. Many had joined the Communist Party and had positions in that regime. Back to Christopoka, until 1929. Things went well, our income was pretty good, and I enjoyed the work. Then the local government began investigating everything. They found something wrong about everything, the way it was being done, the time it was being done, etc., etc. Then the government forced us to hire 5 activists. They did not want to work. I'm sure they were not supposed to work. They were sent to make trouble, and they did. All the older men left. That left 3 young men and 5 activists, who did nothing. But there was really not much work left to do, as we were only allowed to grind flour for people with good documents from the government, and they were very difficult to obtain. We worked until fall. Then one morning we arrived at the mill to find it all boarded up and the doors padlocked. I gathered my things and went home. Before long I found work in another mill in Kordzhokra, which was 18 kilometers from home, and once again I could come home weekends. In the meantime, father had gone to Krasmachok, this is in Danzig-Klobuchkin, and found work delivering brick from the foundry to the businesses needing them. He was rooming with a low-end family. 6 months later, I lost my job again. Another mill closed down. My brother had also lost his job, so we went and joined father. In the summertime, the wagons arrived at a feverish pitch, and my brother and I loaded them, and father delivered the bricks. Father was the only one working officially, so we could leave any time and go to employment officers to look for other work. The unemployment rate in Russia at that time was extremely high, and work almost impossible to find. After 3 months of hounding the employment office, they found a job for me in a small foundry as a mechanic. However, there was very little for a mechanic to do, so I spent most of my time carrying raw iron to the smelting furnace. I was not happy with this work, but I stayed with it until Uncle Henry Michelson and his son Henry, who were working in a small mill in a Prussian village of Bizabatoka, let me know about an opening coming up. I applied for the job and got it. This village was founded by German citizens, but by the time I arrived, most of them had gone back to Germany. Now many Russian-born Germans were working here, and many of them could not speak German. At the mill, we spoke only Russian. I did not get home often enough to practice German, and I could not correspond with my girlfriend. I could not write German, and she could not read Russian. Also, her father would have given her a very hard time if he knew we were corresponding. In spring of 1931, a kolchoz was started in Bibastroka. Of course, this was only for the Russian-German farmers. The German citizens would not allow themselves to be bullied this way. The mill was given over to the kolchoz workers and all, so I became a kolchoz member. Now I had a problem. The kolchoz only paid salaries at the end of the year, according to the productivity. However, I was staying with my aunt, my father's sister, and I had to pay room and board on a weekly or monthly basis. I went to my boss and explained my dilemma. He had the solution. He sent me to Wesedweka, where they were offering a course in accounting. Everything was cost-free, including the room and board. I accepted, wondering how I could manage sitting at a desk all day long. But since I always enjoyed studying, I told myself it would be fine. Uncle Philip, who was a school teacher in Wesedweka and a single man, had room given to him by the school, asked me to stay with him, and we received all our meals in the cafeteria. Then I also received a small allowance and was asked to sign a contract, promising to work wherever I was sent for 2 years after completing the course. My handwriting was pathetic, and grammar, not my best friend. But since most of the others were even worse off than I was, there were many illiterates, especially among the farmers. I was one of the better students, and had to help two other students with their lessons. Somehow, we all completed the course, some better than others, and four of us were sent in the same co-op to do their bookkeeping. That part of the business had been neglected for a long time, and we were to straighten it out. I do not remember exactly what we did, since I was not there very long, when I was sent to a small village where the accountant was being sent to another business. However, when I arrived, the bookkeeper was extremely upset, and said he would leave the district if they transferred him, so they sent me to another village. The bookkeeping here had been neglected for a whole year, and I was to straighten it out. I requested an assistant, and they promised to get one for me, until I had all the bookkeeping up to date. The same promise was made over and over again, but no assistant arrived. After 3 weeks, I handed in my resignation, and they threatened to sue. With the war still going strong, I knew I would be drafted in a very short time, and their threats did not bother me. I don't know whether they sued or not, but I never heard any more about it. Father retired in 1930, came back to Herzenberg, took some land, and started farming again. When I came home late in the summer of 1931, the kolchoz had been established, and Father was a member. My brother had gone to Poligrad and found work in a foundry, and my sister was working as a nurse, 7 kilometers from home. An army officer came to the house the day after I arrived home and informed me that I was a family member and therefore a member of the kolchoz. As such, my duty was to start work for the kolchoz immediately. I could have refused and gone to town to look for work. Things were not very rigid yet, but I thought it might be a nice change to work in the sunshine with other young people, and especially since my future bride was working there. I had seen very little of her in the past. I also knew I would be drafted in the fall. First, we had to harvest the grain. The threshing machines worked day and night. We had just started on one farm. When they sent word, we had to go to another farm. They needed a certain number of men, horses, wagons, ladders, and other necessary tools to harvest a large government crop. All the young people had to go, and we really did not mind. We worked there about 10 days, and when we returned home, there was much talk in the village. All who had at one time been wealthy landowners, of course they no longer had anything, were on the list as Kolokin with the original committee. These would be liquidated in a very short time as enemies of the classes, this meaning that everything they still had would be taken from them, and in the best cases they would be let go to do the best they could. Others would be sent to Siberia. This included my future in-laws. This time for my enlistment came, and I had to go to Krasnodar for registration. It is also where I would come to report for political, social, and medical examinations. This examination had to be very thorough, since the Red Army did not allow anyone who was not physically or politically sound. They did not want any enemies of the classes. I passed all the examinations. I was afraid of the army, but I did want to go into the service. Since all who were not accepted went into the army, they were looked upon. I was afraid of the army, but I did not want to go into the service. since all who were not accepted into the army were looked upon as unsavory elements. A Ukrainian owned a windmill located at one end of Herzenberg, where we lived. He and his family went rented two rooms from Sarah Friesen. We knew her as Tante Sarah. She was single, elderly lady. She lived in the other two rooms. Wasily had been arrested in the spring for non-payment of the rent imposed on him. His family remained with Tante Sarah. One day, I had not gone to work since I had returned very late from Krasmatok the night before. My father had gone to work, and mother and I noticed a vehicle drove up to Tante Sarah's house. Two men stepped out and went in, and I recognized one to be Samura, who was a member of the town council and was known for hating the Germans. His father had been a shepherd for a German family at one time and possibly had been treated badly. The other man was unknown to us at the time, but we were to find out later that he was an unauthorized... agent for our region. Mother suggested that I go over to see what was going on. There are only these two women, and they must be afraid, she said. I went, sat down in the house, and watched. The men were in the miller's rooms, and were making a list of everything they could see. According to Russian law, they should have had a search warrant and two witnesses. Since they had neither, they did not protest my presence, at least that is what I think. In any case, they did not say anything about my being there. Normally it was done this way. Everything was listed. Then a notice was given about an auction, and everything was sold. The monies were given to the government for taxes. When they had finished in the miller's rooms, they went into Tante Sarah's rooms to make sure that nothing belonging to the millers was hidden in her rooms. I followed. They dug through everything. They started digging in a dresser. The man from region found some envelopes. They were difficult to get at the time. Everything was hard to get at the time. He asked Tante Sarah if she would be kind enough to sell him a few. Tante Sarah did not even have time to answer when Samura shouted, "Why are you asking her? Take all of them." This was too much for me to swallow, and I asked, "Do you have the right to take them?" He threw back, "Who are you anyway, sitting and asking me such a question? I may be at your house tomorrow to write down everything you have." I answered, "My identity makes no difference. You cannot take those envelopes. But if you really want to know who I am, I will tell you. I am a citizen of the Soviet Union. Is that enough for you? You may very well come to my house tomorrow to list all my belongings. But if you do, they will be sold, and the monies will go to the government, not to you personally." So we argued back and forth for a while, and I won. He did not take the envelopes. Tante Sarah gave a few to the other man, and they went on their way. Well, I won, but I also made an enemy, and he almost did me great harm later. But more about that for another time. Since the future of my bride and her family looked so bleak, and we did not want to lose each other, I would be inducted into the army soon, so we decided to marry. Early in the morning, I had to go to work. My parents were still in bed, since father worked the second shift.